I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Kushagra Verma. He is the founder of Advanced Spine Care. It's a practice that's focused on providing high-quality spine care for the community. His practice is both concierge and evidence-based, and we're going to talk about what both of those things mean. I have a little confusion on one of those myself, but hopefully neither of us have confusion at the end. And he's a spine surgeon that specializes in minimal, invasive, and complex spine surgery. Dr. Verma, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting, you know, your specialty. It seems like there's so many people. I keep running into people that have some type of back issue, and it's debilitating. I mean, I have a family member that fits that case. I used to have a lot of back pain, which fortunately went away naturally. But let me just start by asking, why do you think we have so many back issues in this country?
Well, back pain is pretty complex. I think you can get back pain from the muscles. You can get it from maybe just being out of shape and carrying too much weight. Also, the spine is like a joint on top of a joint on top of a joint. And you have 33 bones in the spine. And so any of them can get arthritic breakdown. A lot of times people have issues at the bottom two levels. And I would say everybody has some degree of arthritis and probably pain from those bottom two levels. What we sort of lack, I think, in spine is that often we don't have a diagnosis. People have back pain. They see their general practitioner. They're maybe given some therapy or muscle relaxers or something like that. But never do they really get the full workup and know why they have pain and what level is the problem and have good imaging to sort of diagnose the problem. So that's sort of my mission. And when I see patients is, you know, really investigate it.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Well, obviously we want to dig into that, but I also want to kind of go back. I was looking over a little bit of your history, and it looks like you were always destined for medicine. You started off with a biomedical engineering degree.
That's right. I actually didn't think I was going to go to med school. I thought I was going to be an engineer. I was a tinkerer as a kid. I wasn't necessarily the smartest kid in high school when it came to tests, but you know, I did a little science fair project at home as a freshman, and I won the entire state science fair. And everyone was like, "That's really weird for a freshman in high school to do." Then I did it again as a senior. And so I definitely had like a engineering, creative way of, and a good presenter probably too. And that got me into a pretty good engineering school, into Cornell. And I thought that was it. I was going to do engineering. And I kind of got a couple years into it, and I was like, I really can't do this job. I can't sit behind a desk. I'm a people person. I want to be talking to people. And I think the turning point for me is I worked for a company that designed total artificial hearts, which was so cool to me in concept. And I spent every day after work watching surgery videos in their library and being fascinated by surgery. And so I kind of pivoted away from engineering right near the end of college.
Wow. Wow. And now biomedical engineering is kind of a broad area. Was there one part of that that interested you more than others?
Yeah, I was a little more mechanical engineer, and I like shifted into being more biomedical engineering, but I wasn't really that much of an engineer. I really was kind of sure by the end of college, I wanted to go to med school. And I sort of was ready to leave engineering behind, like doing these like long problem sets, sitting there for hours and hours. It just, I didn't think I wanted to do that anymore. It's, I mean, every Thursday night, all the college kids are going to the bars, and all the nerds in the engineering building are sitting there doing problem sets because the problem sets were always due 8 a.m. Friday morning. So we were pulling all-nighters trying to finish it. And I was so burned out. I was like, I'm not doing that the rest of my life.
So I have an engineering, actually a couple degrees, and I was taking an econ class with one of my buddies that was in engineering, and the professor said, "All right, I have a homework assignment for you." And the whole class groaned, and he and I looked at each other, and we started laughing because the longest homework assignment we had in that entire class was like 45 minutes. And in engineering, that's like one problem if you're
Yeah.
lucky.
Yeah. It's one problem. And I'm not actually, to be honest, very good at those problem sets. And at Cornell, everyone is from China or India and they're super smart. So I learned how to make friends and form a team quickly. And we would work together in the library on Thursdays, and I would learn from them and they would learn from me and we would get it done. But it wasn't until med school that I actually got interested in orthopedics. I kind of thought I was going to do high risk OB for a while. I don't know why. I did research in obstetrics and I thought it was cool. And then I saw my first spine surgery as like the last block of third year, which is like near the end of med school. And I just was like, right, this is what I want to do. I want to put screws in the spine. This is the coolest surgery. And, it was kind of a cool, it worked out the right way because there's a lot of engineering principles that go into spine surgery. You're trying to instrument the spine and think about all these mechanical considerations in helping a patient with their back pain. So I think it worked out really well for me that I was an engineer,
Yeah.
but I think there was probably no chance that I would get an engineering job.
Huh. Well, I imagine you would have. I paid my way partially through engineering school by designing amplifiers used for cardiac research at UNC Hospital. And I had some professor that at NC State that figured out how to get NIH money by kind of hiring us out to do some of the instrumentation that the docs needed over at UNC and Duke.
That sounds fun.
It was fascinating. And I mean, you learn a lot. All the patients were animals, so they would do like open heart surgery on pigs. And of course all the patients died because they had such a cocktail of drugs in them by the end of the experiment. But
Yeah.
you have doctors in there eating a ham sandwich while they're looking over this beating heart. And
Sounds so normal.
so the one thing you mentioned, when you was this in your residency that you ended up going over to Africa?
It was actually in medical school. So I got interested in spine. I was a little late to the game. I didn't have the best grades. You have to, unfortunately, the way the med school system works is you've got to crush these tests in order to get into the more competitive specialties. And I was never a test taker, exceptional test taker. I was a little bit of a disadvantage, but I wanted to do orthopedics and spine. And this one surgeon, Professor Boachi, I heard him give a talk on global outreach. And I was 2008 or maybe early 2009. I basically ran up to him at the end of the meeting and I was like, please take me with you. This is what I want to do. And he did. And he took me to Africa in Ghana at the, I think it was the end of 2009. And I had such a great experience. I got to watch really complex pediatric spine surgery being done in West Africa, which sounds crazy. But they
Yeah.
really had it really dialed in and they just gradually made incremental improvements. You got to work with the local surgeons. It was a really good environment fostering like collaboration. It like really, it was everything you want to be as a doctor in Africa. It was like, oh, this is why I want to be a doctor. I want to do this kind of work. I want to be helping people in underserved areas and doing these complex cases. It really changed me. I was like pretty much like I'm going to do spine surgery. After that, I went to residency in Jefferson in Philly, the Rothman Institute, and I kind of kept up my interest in outreach. I did research on outreach work. I even went back to Africa a couple of times as a resident and at the end of fellowship. And then I had the opportunity to work with other people. I went to Colombia, I went to Mexico, And then I've also gone back to Africa, which I always have a soft spot for because it was the first place I went. And it's a really special thing that someone has given me is this like career interest.
Did it? Do you think that the environment forced more creativity? So generally, what I find is the more constraints we have, or the more scarcity we have, the more creative we become. And so, in terms of what you saw in Africa, did you see, because, and maybe I have wrong think, because when I think about Africa, I think greatly impoverished, minimalistic medical facilities and all of that. And so I'm wondering, one, is that the case? Is that what you found? And then two, did that foster different types of problem solving that we might not naturally do here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's a little bit of both. The facilities, they built a hospital there. They're actually exceptional. The OR is great, their protocols, everything is great. But they don't have all the fancy tools. They don't have a robot, they don't have like navigation. And so you are relying a bit more on visualization, seeing the spine, seeing your landmarks, putting the screws in based off feel and things like that. And then in these cases, they don't have any landmarks. Like the spine sometimes is twisted completely in half, like a pretzel. And, all your normal landmarks are disturbed, and it's very disorienting. You're like, well, where's the spinal cord? What is this, a bone? Is this like, is this lung? So from a surgical perspective, it's very t challenging. It challenges your brain to be better. And you don't, any sort of advanced technology won't help you in these cases. It wouldn't be helpful. You have to rely on instinct and palpating the little piece of bone where you want to put in the screw. And so it sharpens your skills as a surgeon for sure. But I wouldn't say the quality is any less than. You just have to be, I think, appropriate for that environment. Like if you have a really huge curve and you have to correct it, you're going to correct it, but maybe you're slightly less aggressive in an outreach setting than you would be at home, where you had, the ICU person, everything, you have all the comforts of being in America. You'd maybe be a little bit less aggressive, but I think the quality is the same.
Now, there were a couple terms you used, and I will tell you, one of those terms has me completely confused, and that was concierge. And I thought I understood concierge, and then all the direct med guys told me, no. I thought what they were doing was concierge. So, first off, high level, what is concierge, and then how's that
Well,
different than direct med?
we're seeing this trend. Sorry, my light turned off. Let me turn it on real quick. We're seeing this trend for sure in healthcare, where primary care is going splitting into two tiers. Really, you have more concierge level care and then a little bit less concierge. And what that means is like you can reach out to your doctor, you have their cell phone number, the doctor spends extra time with you. And in primary care, they're often charging a fee for this extra service. In our practice, we don't really charge a fee, but I love the concept of taking care of people like they're your family member, that they have immediate access to the doctor, that they can call and text, that the patient that walks in the door feels extremely well cared for. I think that concept in healthcare should not die. It's a little bit old school. It's, the way maybe your parents described going to see a doctor. They had like 45-minute visits and they could spend a lot of time with their doctor. We want that same experience. It's challenging to run a practice like that. One of the reasons I'm solo. I have an independent practice because we don't always have to follow all the rules of a big group. We can kind of choose to care for our patients the way we want. And I think the patient experience is better. So if it's better for the patients and the doctors want it, why don't we all run our practices like that? So that's what it means to me is, I go above and beyond. People have my cell phone number. We spend a lot of time with people before and after surgery.
Well, I mean, in kind of evidence of that, before we hit record, you gave me your cell phone number. And I honestly, I think you're the first doctor that's ever given me a cell phone number.
I mean, that's the way everyone has it. Now, sometimes they'll reach out to me and they'll be kind of disappointed. They'll be like, "Oh, doc, can you call in this prescription?" And I'll say, "Please call the office."
Yeah.
Because I'm in surgery or clinic or whatever, but it basically means that if there's an issue and it's an emergency, they can reach out to me. They can get to me. I can help. And I was laying down to go to sleep last night, and before I went to bed, I was like, "Oh, I got to check on my patient that I operated on." And that's just like a gut instinct that I have. I got to call the nurse, got to make sure he's doing okay, that his pain is okay overnight, and then I can go to bed
Yeah.
and not worry. So that's the way we've always practiced. That's how I was able to build a practice, and so I don't really intend on changing that.
And how would you describe the difference between what you do and direct med?
What is direct med? Actually, I don't even know what that is.
Well, and that I maybe this is some of my confusion. So I had originally heard of concierge about 20 years ago, a little more than 20 years ago. And then I saw people around Austin doing it. And the way now that's more for primary care where I see it. And
Yeah.
basically, you pay a monthly subscription, but you also have direct access to, when you go in, you're not seeing the PA. And a
Yeah.
lot of the same claims that you're making, it's not that you get 5 minutes with them and they're gone. They stay a little bit longer, they're reachable after hours. I've even heard of some cases where they'll do a home visit. If you're calling it if for whatever reason it just makes most sense for them to come to your home, they'll come to your home. Now we don't have the traffic that LA has, so that's a lot easier to do.
Yeah.
But
It's the same idea. We
yeah.
just don't do as many cases. I think there's a little bit of pressure from the insurance companies to run your office like a factory, doing a high volume of cases. I kind of did that for a while and I didn't like it, and I don't think it really works. And so now we just bring down the volume and spend more time with people and do a better job, I think. I think that's really where I want healthcare to be. I want to model my practice after what I think spine surgery should be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, my personal belief is that the traditional insurance model is not sustainable. I mean, the rating, double digit year on year rate increases. I just in a couple months my insurance is going to bump up another 20%.
Yeah.
And bumped up 20% last year. And I just don't think that's sustainable. And then when you go to get care, you end up battling about what's covered and what's not covered. And it used to be, I mean, years ago, I'm on one of the pre-ACA plans that's a high deductible plan because my view is I want to use insurance for the catastrophic. So when I went in the hospital for 3 months, it's exactly what I needed. It was
Yeah.
wonderful. We're not bankrupt.
Yeah.
But below the deductible, except for 3 years in a row, I've never hit my deductible. And that gives me the freedom to go find, if I decide I need something for my care, I just go get it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what a lot of people are doing. We're seeing a lot of the same struggles on our end. Like, they keep raising the rates on patients, but a lot of insurance companies want to pay Medicare rates, which Medicare hasn't increased what they pay doctors in like 30 or 40 years. You
Wow.
know, like my friend had an emergency spine surgery on his dog, and they needed to do a laminectomy on the dog, and the veterinarian charged $13,000 for that surgery. Medicare pays $1,300 for that same surgery on a human. So you can just imagine that if all the insurances and Medicare are following these rates, it just doesn't work. It's a real challenge to try to run a practice. A lot of times we're seeing things not get approved. Patients have to call, file grievances, still doesn't get approved. They're not getting approved for any good reason. They're just wanting to deny surgeries.
Yeah.
So we spend a lot of time fighting those battles, and we usually need our patients to help us,
Yeah.
call their insurance and things like that. That's the ugly side of healthcare. But I think if you have a good staff behind you and you're persistent, eventually you'll get your surgery.
Yeah. The yeah. The other term that you used is evidence-based medicine. And I know that's a term that's been around for a while. And my perception is most people don't know what that means. And those that do know what it means don't necessarily follow it.
Yeah, well, spine's really tough. It's complicated. Cervical, thoracic, lumbar, and there's a lot of research. In general, I think spine is moving in two directions. The one and two level problems, the stuff most of us have, are becoming more minimally invasive. Smaller incisions, smaller surgeries, outpatient, more disc replacement. That's definitely happening. On the other side, the more complex stuff, we're doing that better. So we do have research that's being done. Some of the research is a little hard to interpret. Does this apply to my patient or not? But what I try to do is use my academic background and also stay on top of what's being done and present that research to the patients. That's what I mean by evidence-based, is I give people a diagnosis. Okay, this is the bad level, this is the issue, this is the diagnosis, these are the different ways to treat it, and here are the pieces of data that we have in terms of what the outcomes are long term. And then I usually go into it a little more and say, but my opinion, based off my personal experience, is maybe this and that is better. And some of it's evidence-based and some of it's what we call level five evidence, which means it's expert opinion. This is what I've seen as a surgeon for 5 years. This is what my friends are doing that are surgeons. This is a trend I've seen. So that people have more than just, okay, doc, you're the doctor, I'll do the surgery. I want them to be involved in the decision making. Truly, I mean, we made really big TVs in all the exam rooms so people can see their imaging. A lot of what we're doing is this kind of stuff during our consults. I'm really explaining to them the problem, showing them the models, and also going over the literature and then where we don't have literature. Where's the controversy? A lot of times people can see two or three spine surgeons and get six opinions. And they'll be like, what do I do here? And the truth is, you kind of have to sometimes make your own decision about do I do one level versus two, open, minimally invasive, things like that.
Well, and the way you just laid that out is my understanding of evidence-based. That it's, there's basically three main elements. There's an element of there's the research that's out there. Then there's the expertise of the doctor or the surgeon that you're dealing with. And then the third element of evidence-based is patient preferences, pulling the patient
Yeah.
in. And in my own personal journey, I've heard people claim evidence-based where they only follow one of those three things. They toss out the other two.
Yeah. I mean, a component of what I try to do is go to meetings and I like get dinner with other spine surgeons and try to get their opinions on what's being done that's different. In general, as a general rule, I try to only operate in the 97% success rate, which means 97, 98% of people that come in, if they choose to have surgery, they're happy with their outcome. And, that means we kind of reject all the surgeries that I don't think work. And so if we don't have literature that supports greater than 90% success rate, I won't do that surgery. And that means certain surgeries like SI fusions, I don't really do because the literature has been a little all over the place. Spinal cord stimulators, I don't really do that surgery. And sometimes I lose business because somebody else will do it. But I think it's better not to. I think I'd prefer. And then some of the complex surgery we do, to be honest, if it's really big, complicated revision surgery, complication rate is quite high. It's often a small complication, but it can be a wound infection, a readmission, it can be a small medical issue. That number is over 50%. And so I have conversations with people that are thinking about complex spine surgery and for their, grandmother that's 70. I'll have these conversations and discuss the evidence. Hey, the complication rate's really high. And so we only do those types of surgeries when someone is truly disabled, in severe pain, can't walk. But I think patients have a right to know what the data is sort of saying and what's new and what's out there.
So let me ask you this. There's obviously a lot of people they're struggling with back pain. I mentioned somebody I know in my family who's struggling with it. For somebody that just has chronic back pain, would be, in as much as you could give generic advice in this forum, what would you advise they do?
No, that's a great question because I get it all the time. If you had chest pain, you'd really want a cardiologist to get an EKG, chest X-ray, maybe a stress test to figure it out. What I see a lot on my specialty is people have back pain. Maybe they go to therapy. Maybe it gets better. Maybe it doesn't. They've never gotten a diagnosis. So I'm a big proponent on everyone should get a good set of X-rays, get an MRI, and see a spine surgeon. 95% of the people I see don't need surgery, at least right away. But it's important that they have a diagnosis. Is there really one really bad level? Is it spinal stenosis? Is the nerve pinched? Is it a spondylolisthesis where the bone slipped out of place? There's lots of different things that could be going on that can cause back pain. And I think going down the rabbit hole, a couple of visits with a spine surgeon is very valuable. After you've done all that, you want to do all the non-surgical stuff before you ever think about surgery, which is physical therapy, core strengthening, weight loss. If people are carrying an extra 30 or 40 pounds, especially around their midsection, and they have a weak core, they're going to have back pain. If they have a job where they're doing a lot of repetitive heavy lifting, it's going to put a lot of strain on the back. If they have a bad level and they're doing heavy lifting from the floor, it's going to aggravate it. So I think a combination of strengthening your core, weight loss, and getting a good diagnosis is probably the most important thing.
It's interesting. I mentioned to you, I think in the green room, that I go to something called Camp Gladiator. I used to have to go to get therapeutic massages on a regular basis. And I told my wife the other day, I said, since I've been going to Camp Gladiator, I haven't really needed a massage. And they start every workout with a series of stretches. They usually start stretching and end stretching.
I think it's super valuable. I strength train myself 5 days a week because I'm always looking into the future. I know what it looks like if you're 70 and you don't take care of yourself and you've got extra weight and you've lost a lot of muscle. But the other part of this that we don't really know is the value of stretching. And there's like stretch labs that have opened up in different places around my town. And I think there's a lot of value to keeping your joints mobile, stretching. There's even data that just stretching alone helps build muscle. Forget about strength training. Just stretching the muscles stimulates muscle growth. So that can be a great thing everybody does. I mean, my wife does yoga, and I was always like, this isn't a real workout. What are you doing? Sure enough, I mean, she's been doing yoga 6 months, 2 or 3 days a week. She's gotten very strong, and it's like 5 pound weights and holding funny positions. But I think there's a lot of value to stretching and you don't have to necessarily strength train to have a strong physique and build muscle.
So let's wrap up with this. What advice would you give to folks so that they never need to walk through the door of your office?
Well, I would say don't be afraid to walk into the door because most of the time we're not telling people they need surgery. And that information is super valuable to know what's going on because everybody has back pain. And it would be helpful to know, is it one bad level? Is it two bad levels? Is it? I think that knowledge isn't something we should be afraid of. The other thing is, I think having a strong core, staying lean are really good ways to avoid back pain. And the types of activities that I think really seem to trigger back pain is really heavy deadlifts and like really heavy squats because a lot of times people have disc problem, right? The disc is a little worn out. When you're doing really heavy squats, you're loading that disc and you can trigger back pain, discogenic type back pain. And if you're doing deadlifts where you're bending over with the weight, if you've got a level that's a little unstable and it's slipping out of place, then bending over is going to aggravate that type of pain. So those are the two activities I tell people, and I do squats and deadlifts every week. But if I had back pain, I would back off of those activities and I would get an X-ray and an MRI and try to figure it out. Why am I getting that pain?
Well, Dr. Verma, this has been very interesting. How can folks reach you?
They can reach us by calling our office number, 562-732-4578. We're also on Instagram at advancedspinecareasc.md. They can also follow me on Instagram, Kushagra Verma MD. It's a little bit of a mouthful, Kushagra. But that's why we made a practice Instagram too, asc.md. We like to post a lot of educational content there. We also have a website, advancedspinecare.com. And if you're anywhere in Southern California, I'm happy to see you and hopefully give you good information.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that on Leaders and Legacies.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. And it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.